What hole? What hole?
More wine for the DJs. They need more wine.
What hole?
So, I don't know why you guys can't kind of start now.
We've been going this whole time.
Yeah, we are going.
Yeah.
And Joe is going. He's moving.
It's happening.
Moving along the background.
Yes.
Joe, our new technical... what's your title now?
Gunther.
Joe.
Technical Gunther?
Which channel is returning this to me?
Gunther.
This one?
Turntables. Yeah.
Okay, so turntables. Great.
Were these brought here tonight? Should I eat these or no?
Yeah, I'm just trying to...
I never know.
But...
Yeah,
I'm going to have to... I bet at least from Sunday on.
Yeah, sure.
So it's half a week or closer. The wine's fresh. I'd say just drink...
The box has been painted. That's a little sketchy.
The box has been painted?
Mm-hmm. Seems like some kunst happened all over it. Good evening and welcome to
the talking show
on K-Chung Radio. Getting this there? Yeah. And, I don't know who those other guys were. Do you have any idea who those guys were?
Yeah, our guest tonight brought a posse, as they say.
Oh, that's who those giggling guys were.
Yeah, they are part of our guest tonight's posse.
Interesting.
Wait. I think in LA they call it an entourage.
The entourage, yeah.
Entourage.
Our guests.
LA, the most French of American cities.
It's even also got its own Venice too, so it's like sort of pan-European,
right?
In aspect,
Venice, just like Hollywood, was a marketing scam, right?
Yeah, the canals are fake.
Yeah,
I mean, they weren't for a reason,
mm-hmm.
except as a sort of mimetic concept.
That is something that American developers do. They go. You know, they're born here. They go to Europe for a trip, and they're inspired to recreate the old land here.
That's right. That's exactly right.
Europeans don't do that. It doesn't work the other way, does it?
You know, it's interesting you say that. That's not entirely true. For example, Adolf Loos started his journal. What was it called? Die Fackeln, the torch.
I don't know.
And the job of the journal, this is in 19-teens, 1800s, Vienna. The goal of said journal was to bring Western culture, by which he meant American culture, to Europe.
Hmm.
He saw in the flexibility and mobility in American culture everything that was lacking in the... in the culture of the 1800s Vienna that raised him. And it turns out to have been a prophetic thing on his part, because the Habsburg Empire that he lived in did in fact crumble leading up to World War I.
So.
Right? And America's still here.
Right.
So if you had been a debt holder of the Habsburg Empire, you would be fucked. But if you have a T-bond from the Treasury,
yeah,
you're doing fine. It's a stable investment.
Or you could just come over here. I think a lot of them just came over here after the war, right?
I mean, sure, that was also a thing that happened. But, and also, I mean, Europe just didn't accept as many immigrants, which I think in a weird way, just not to be too current eventsy about it, but I think that does have, it'd be weird for a talk show not to mention it this week, but I think some chickens came home to roost in France on the issue of how immigrants are treated in Europe. You know, not to say that anyone deserves anything, because I don't believe that death is an appropriate response to for satirical cartoons per se, but you know, I don't know. My own experience living in Europe certainly bore out the sheer alienation of most monolithic European societies.
Well, supposedly the French don't acknowledge race, right? Or something like this?
Not on a legal basis, which is progressive. I mean, like, the idea is that the French Revolution created the substantially more progressive ideas we have here in our daily life in North America. Yet, the execution of those ideas in cultural reality are significantly different there. I mean, everything's getting more conservative. That's the horrible part. I mean, like, the Muslim world was also formerly more flexible back when they invented math and everything like that. You know, things were really popping off.
Algebra.
Yeah. And now, you know, in North America, everyone suddenly became really religious.
Well, that was always the case, right?
I mean, that was an initial case, but it was also non-conforming Protestant sects as opposed to sort of highly conforming Protestant sects. It was a different thing. A country founded by a bunch of weird Quakers is a different thing than
mega churches in the Midwest.
That is a very different thing. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And sort of from our last guest, Governor Jerry Brown, we have another guest who's a Californian, in this case a transplant Californian, and now that his shareholders have calmed down, we don't have all that giggling in the studio anymore. There's still a little giggling from the shareholders, but
they have a lot to giggle about these days.
You know, it does go up and down. Our guest's main line of business has been actually hit hard by the drop in oil prices.
I'm sure.
But
one of his ventures is always rising.
So to speak, yeah, or at least orbiting, going round and round up there. we have in our studio, this is a real coup for the talking show.
We had to twist many arms and legs to get our guest tonight.
Even to just get, honestly, a phone number that could get answered. Mm-hmm. We have in our studio probably the closest thing our generation has to sort of like a Richie Rich boy genius ever. None other than Elon Musk.
Right. And you'd be surprised at it's one of those things where you think, how are we going to get a hold of this guy? And actually, it was surprisingly easy. His email is elonmusk@yahoo.com. Who would have thought? You think there would have been layer upon layer of fake emails in front of what would be the most obvious.
Exactly.
But sometimes you gotta take a stab.
And we tried a lot of them too. We tried elon@spacex.com.
Yeah, that didn't work. That gets you some secretary.
Yeah, it doesn't work. Does not work. You know, and one thing that he does say in other lectures I've heard of his is that the only way to really do it is to just work harder than your competition. And so I think when he saw the extent of our efforts to communicate with him, the fact that we had gone to I think the yahoo.com thing is sort of a test.
Yeah.
If you make it there, you know, then he'll at least give you, you know, 30 seconds of his attention to scan the email.
Well, the strange thing that he just admitted to us when he arrived in the studio with his shareholders tonight is that he has been a fan of the talking show almost since the beginning.
It's interesting. Yes, it's true. And the reason why, among other things, is that Teslas as vehicles, and of course he drives a Tesla. Let's just put it out there. He arrived in a Tesla.
There were a couple of them.
The shareholders, many of them drive Teslas. The Tesla. Some of them are carpooling because some of them are a little drunk, which is good. Don't drive your Tesla if you're drunk. It works the same as a regular car when it comes to vehicular manslaughter. It's not different. But when the shareholders showed up, and Elon, they all showed up in Teslas. Where was I going?
Well, I was just pointing out that Elon admitted he'd been listening almost since the beginning.
Oh, that's right. And the reason why is that the amazing entertainment console on the Tesla, it's essentially a touchscreen in the Tesla S series. And you can easily just listen to internet radio as if it was nothing.
Right.
But and therefore, he's actually been able to listen to K-Chung this whole time. He's actually a big fan of all of K-Chung.
Which is surprising.
Yeah.
But the funny thing is that he first heard of the show because during our first e-blast, Steve and I had taken on some alcoholic beverages.
Uh-huh.
And we just added all sorts of names to the e-blast. And
that's
Elon
true.
Musk at Yahoo.
Which it seemed pretty funny.
It seemed like a joke, but lo and behold.
It actually worked. And we had no idea that it had connected with its desired target.
Yeah, so let that be a lesson to all of you young aspiring artists and entrepreneurs. Get drunk.
Dare to try.
Yeah. Work harder.
Work harder than the competition. Show up for work more than the competition shows up for work.
Right.
And our guest has, although they're building the Gigafactory in Nevada, and he'll talk a little bit about that, I'm sure. Elon Musk moved to California via Canada.
Wow.
From South Africa originally. And he'll mention, and he'll talk about how he's arrived at the point that he is. But at the moment, you know, even our former guest, Governor Jerry Brown, has saluted Mr. Musk for bringing genuine manufacturing, engineering, and design talent together in California. And Mr. Musk lives in Los Angeles. And,
Did he mention whereabouts his house is?
His house is up high. It's in the deeper Bel Air area.
I see.
He's a 405 commuter, which is like a hard cross to bear with all the construction on the 405.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, he had a few choice words with the governor, actually, about the way the construction had been laid out on the 405. Because, of course, he had a better idea.
I'm sure.
A more efficient, more accurate idea. Anyway, so let's just let one of our generation's few, perhaps few real industrialist geniuses take the stage here at K-Chung. We're very honored to have the founder and CEO of Tesla Motors, the founder and CEO simultaneously of SpaceX.
Don't forget PayPal.
He co-created PayPal, which he's now not connected to. Also Zip2, I think.
Those big floppies?
It's a different company that was instrumental in putting newspapers on the internet.
Oh, I thought you're talking iOmega, I think, made the big Zip.
That's a different company. Yeah. He started with this other thing that's... How about we let Elon tell his story at the beginning of his talk, and we'll get all the facts covered, and then we'll rejoin you again after Mr. Musk has had his say. Some of the shareholders are actually asleep on the couch here now. It seems like the excitement was just too much. Ladies and gentlemen, on K-Chung Radio, the one and only Elon Musk.
Introduction. It's an honor to be here. This is an incredibly beautiful theater. It's amazing to be in a place designed by Christopher Wren. And speaking of Brunel, actually, I'm a big fan of Brunel. I have five boys, and I really wanted to name one of them Brunel. or Eisenbart. I like them. No luck. Hopefully one in the future. I'll just tell you the story of how I came to be here, or you know, the various things that I did and maybe why I did them, and hopefully that's a bit helpful. And then we're going to have quite a long question and answer session. So I'd look forward to, you know, feel free to ask me any question, no matter how provocative or you know challenge what we're doing. I'm actually always interested in negative feedback, actually. So so the way I started out was I did start out in South Africa, went to Pretoria Boys High, and then left actually by myself initially to go to Canada, and then the U.S. to college, and graduating from undergrad, I had to sort of make a decision, one path would have sort of led to Wall Street and I guess quite a big salary, and then the other would have was to do grad studies and try to figure out a technical problem, and I didn't much like the first one, so I decided to go out to Silicon Valley and go to Stanford and try to work on ultracapacitors for use in electric vehicles. And I do actually think there's potential for a significant breakthrough in that area, and actually to have an energy storage mechanism that's better than batteries. It's not necessary for transport to go electric, but I think it is. It's something that would accelerate that. So I was sort of about to get into grad studies, and then the internet. It was clear that the internet was going to be something that would be very important to the future. So I thought, well, I could either sort of spend 5 years in a graduate program and discover that the answer is that there is no way to make a capacitor work, and get perhaps get some nice papers published and that kind of thing, but that would be a most unfortunate situation, I thought. Because you can come to one of the possible things is to determine that success is not one of the possible outcomes. I couldn't actually bracket the uncertainty on that. So I thought I can either do that, or I can work on building elements of the internet. And this was in '95, so nobody had actually made any money on the internet. But I thought the internet would be something that would fundamentally change the nature of humanity, where it was like humanity gaining a nervous system. Where all of a sudden, any part of humanity would know what the collective would have access to the collective knowledge, and that's true. It's really quite a remarkable transformation. In the past, you'd have to, and if you wanted access to a lot of information, you'd have to be near a big library or something, like the Great Bodleian Library nearby, then that'd be the only way to gain access to information. Now with the internet, with everything online, you could be somewhere in the jungles of South America, and if you've got access to an internet connection, you have access to essentially all the world's information, with a tremendous amount of analytical power behind that. So I think it literally has gone from a situation where people would communicate almost like via osmosis. If you can imagine sort of a creature, a simple multicellular creature that would communicate via quite slow chemical signals. And now, any part of humanity knows what every other part of humanity does immediately. It's pretty incredible. So anyway, I wanted to be part of building that, so I decided to do a couple of internet companies, and that actually worked out reasonably well. The first one helped bring the media companies online, and then we sold that, and then started another company which you may have used called PayPal, and that we sold for actually a larger sum of money to eBay, and that left me in the fortunate position of having the capital to pursue the two other things that I thought would most affect the future of humanity, being sustainable energy, both the production and consumption of energy in a sustainable manner, which I think is arguably the most pressing problem of the 21st century. And then the other one, which is the extension of life beyond Earth. The one I did first was the space company. The genesis of that is kind of interesting, because at first I didn't think that it would be possible to create a rocket company, and I thought the what would really make a difference is to have a mission to Mars, a small sort of send a small payload to the surface of Mars that would get the public excited about to reignite the passion for space exploration, such that we could go beyond what we did with the Apollo program. And I thought it was quite sad that the Apollo program represented the high watermark of human space exploration. It was not something that I was able to witness in real time, because I was minus two when they landed. It just seemed as though that if I thought about the future, one where we were a true space-faring civilization out there exploring the stars and making the things real that we read in science fiction books and movies, that seems like a really, really exciting future that sort of made me feel good about the future, and one where we were forever confined to Earth made me feel a bit sad. So, that's really what I was trying to figure out is how do we reverse that? And then, like I said, at first I didn't think it would be possible to create a space company because it seemed like the province of governments. But my first thought was, well, let's see if we can do a philanthropic mission to Mars and get the public excited about the idea of going there, and then that would lead to an increased budget for NASA, and then we could go there. That would hopefully work. So I figured out how to compress the cost of the spacecraft and the communication systems and the payload and so forth. It would have been a small greenhouse about a meter across with seeds and dehydrated nutrient gel that would land. You'd hydrate the gel upon landing, and you'd have this great shot of green plants against a red background. In the U.S., that's called the money shot. The public tends to respond to precedents and superlatives. So this would be the first life on another planet, the furthest that life's ever traveled. And I thought, okay, well, that would get people pretty excited, and maybe they could envision people being there. But we'd certainly be able to figure out a lot of engineering and scientific data about what it took to maintain plant life on the surface of Mars. So I got through most of that, and the thing I got hung up on was the rocket. Getting there in the first place. The U.S. options from Boeing and Lockheed were simply too expensive. I couldn't afford them. And so I went to Russia three times to negotiate purchasing an ICBM. of course. I mean, desperate times call for desperate measures. So, I went there. I did three visits there, and at the end of it, I was able to get to negotiate a price actually to buy three of these things, three of the largest ICBMs in the Russian fleet. But they were still pretty expensive, and by the third trip, I actually came to the conclusion that I was operating under the wrong premise. That I was actually mistaken about the willingness to send people to Mars to expand the space frontier. In retrospect, was quite silly of me to think that people were not interested in such a thing or had lost the will to do this. In fact, people had really thought that it's not possible, or not possible for an amount of money that wouldn't materially affect their standard of living. So I came to the conclusion that even if we succeeded in doing this mission, that wouldn't be enough. That would perhaps add a little bit more to the will to do it, but it wouldn't make it clear to people that there was a way. And this is a case of sort of almost the opposite. I think if you can show people that there is a way, then there is plenty of will. So after that third trip, I'd learned a lot more about rockets at that point, and I held a series of meetings, just sort of brainstorming sessions, with people from the space industry to try to understand if there was if I was missing something fundamental about the ability to improve rocketry. And this is where I think it's helpful to use the approach, the analytical approach in physics, which is to try to boil things down to first principles and reason from there, as opposed to reasoning by analogy. So the way this applied to rocketry was to say, okay, well, what are the materials that go into a rocket? How much does each material constituent weigh? What's the cost of that raw material? And that's going to set some floor as to the cost of the rocket. And that actually turns out to be a relatively small number. Certainly, well under 5% of the cost of a rocket, and in some cases closer to 1 or 2%. I call it sort of maybe the magic wand number. So if you had a pile of the raw material, piles of raw materials on the floor, and you could just wave a magic wand and rearrange them, then that would be the best case scenario for a rocket. And so I was able to see, okay, well, there's clearly a great deal of room for improvement, even if you consider rockets to be expendable. So I think that's sort of that's what I mean by sort of thinking about things from a first principle standpoint. If on the other hand, I sort of analyzed it by analogy and said, okay, well, analogy would be, well, what are all other rocket companies, what do their rockets cost? What historically have other rockets cost? And that would be sort of an analogy thing, but it really doesn't illustrate what the true potential is. So I think a sort of a first principles approach is a good way to understand what new things are possible. So this is a good framework. And it doesn't mean you'll be successful, but you know, at least you can determine if success is one of the possibilities. That is important, I think. So I started SpaceX and initially decided to make a small rocket called the Falcon 1 that was capable of putting about half a ton into orbit. This did not go smoothly, I should point out. It was quite difficult to attract the key technical talent, and of course I was quite ignorant of many things and made lots of mistakes along the way. The first three flights of the Falcon 1 failed, or rather they certainly didn't get to orbit. The second and third flights arguably got to space, but they did not reach full orbital velocity. And then fortunately, the fourth flight worked. And if it hadn't, SpaceX wouldn't be around, because I'd basically run out of money. So that was a bit of a nail biter. Thank goodness. This all happened in 2008. There was really no ability to raise outside money in a meaningful way in 2008 because of the financial crisis. So you can imagine trying to go to raise money, saying, "Well, yes, we just had four failures and the world is in financial ruin, but would you like to give us some money?" That would be a definite no. So fortunately, that succeeded, and we were able to go from Falcon 1 to begin designing the Falcon 9, which is an order of magnitude larger vehicle, and in fact has more than 20 times the payload. So it's got a payload to orbit of over 10 tons, and that actually has gone a lot better because we had the experience of Falcon 1 to go by. And part of the reason we started with Falcon 1 was because I thought we would make a lot of mistakes, and if we're going to make a lot of mistakes, then it's best to make those mistakes at a small scale rather than at a large scale. And that seems to have worked, because going to Falcon 9, we've had four flights of Falcon 9, and they've all all four of them have been successful. So I think that principle seems to have worked reasonably well. You know, touch wood in the light. Flight 5 is coming up soon. And then we also developed the Dragon spacecraft because somewhat opportunistically, NASA announced that they were going to retire the space shuttle, and they needed to, they didn't have the budget to develop a cargo transport capability to the space station by the normal large government way, and so they put it out to bid to commercial industry for the first time in NASA history. It was quite a big step, and we were lucky enough to win one of those contracts, and then the other company wasn't able to execute, and so they got cut, and so we ended up being the primary means of transporting cargo to and from the space station. So we just did the first two missions, the first two space station resupply missions this year, and thankfully both of those worked. And then going from there, NASA then said, well, what about astronaut transport? And so they put out a big competition and awarded two contracts for astronaut transport, one of which went to Boeing. They got a slightly larger contract, and then one to us. And so hopefully in about 3 years, we will have Dragon version 2 and the next generation Falcon 9 rockets transporting astronauts to and from the space station. Then we've got Falcon Heavy, which is about three times the capability of Falcon 9, and that will hopefully launch in about a year or two. That'll actually be the most powerful rocket in the world by a factor of two. So we're making sort of steady progress. The Falcon Heavy, to put that into perspective, has about 60% of the capability of the Saturn V moon rocket. So if you were to combine two flights of Falcon Heavy with orbital rendezvous and docking, you could actually send people back to the surface of the moon. So I think now we're really sort of talking about, you know, advancing the frontier, which I think is quite important. And then the really major breakthrough that's needed in rocketry, the pivotal one, which we're aspiring to make, is to have a fully and rapidly reusable rocket. This has not been achieved before. The space shuttle was an attempt to achieve that, but it was not a successful attempt, unfortunately. The main tank of the space shuttle was thrown away every time, which was also the primary ascent aeroframe. Even the parts that were reusable were so difficult to reuse for the space shuttle that it ended up costing four times more than an expendable rocket of equivalent payload capability. But it was the right goal, but didn't hit the target. I think this is actually incredibly important. I think it may not be completely intuitive, but I think perhaps if one refers to other modes of transport, it makes more sense, because all other modes of transport are fully and rapidly reusable, and that applies to a bicycle, a horse, plane, ships. In fact, in sort of normal life, it would be quite silly to, you know, discard your horse after every ride, or dump the plane after you flew it. The cost of a 747 is about $300 million, and you'd need two of those to do a round trip from Los Angeles to London. But I don't think anyone has paid $500 million to do that. So, nor would one want to. I mean, there'd be a lot of travel by boat and train and that sort of thing if that was the true cost. So it's extremely important in rocketry to achieve full and rapid reusability. This is not an easy thing to do because of Earth's gravity well and just the basic physics of things. So there have been many attempts to create a reusable rocket, but they've generally, they've all sort of been canceled along the way. Once people realized that they would not succeed. In fact, usually they got canceled quite some time after it was obvious they wouldn't succeed. But the essence of the problem is that if you design an expendable rocket and do quite a good job of it, you'll get 2 to 3% of your liftoff mass to orbit. Then if you say, well, how much mass is needed to return that rocket and be able to fly it again quickly? Well, about 2-3%. So you can basically get nothing to orbit, is the way it's been in the past. So in order to do something useful, what you have to figure out is how do you get a much larger percentage to orbit, let's say ideally on the order of 4% of your liftoff mass to orbit in an expandable configuration, and then compress the reusable elements down to about 2%, so you have a net payload to orbit of 2%, and then you could really have something that's quite useful. And the cost of the propellant is only about, let's say, 0.3% of the cost of the vehicle. If you take Falcon 9, for example, which uses quite expensive fuel, relatively speaking, I think there are lower cost options. The cost of refueling or reloading propellant on Falcon 9 is about $200,000, and the cost of the rocket is $60 million. So it's just like a plane. I mean, it's just, if you were to refuel a plane, not very expensive. If you want to buy a new plane, very expensive. At this point, I'm really reasonably confident that it can be done, and now it's a question of executing to make that design work, and seeing if there are any gotchas. And there'll probably be a few craters along the way, so I'm not expecting this to be a smooth journey. As long as the rocket doesn't land on anyone, it'll be fine. So that's really what SpaceX is focused on right now, is kind of scaling up the size of the rockets and trying to achieve this full and rapid reusability. So if you're curious, you can just, we're fairly public about things, and you can just follow it on the SpaceX website. So that's what we're doing on the SpaceX side. Then in parallel, we've got Tesla, which is developing electric vehicles, and so sort of a whole separate storyline. And tell me if I'm going on too long, and stop me at any point. Feel free to leave if it's getting boring. I won't be offended. So with Tesla, the goal is to try to create electric vehicles that are more compelling than gasoline vehicles as a product. The fundamental issue we have in energy and transport is the tragedy of the commons. You know, we've got the CO2 capacity of the oceans and atmosphere that is unpriced, or mostly unpriced. And so it's almost like we're sort of dumping garbage in the atmosphere and nobody's paying for garbage collection. So it's the most unfortunate situation, because there are quite significant vested interests in oil, gas, and coal, with enormous amounts of money. It's quite a difficult battle to fight, and you can't expect them to simply roll over and commit suicide or something. They will fight it hard, and they have been. So unfortunately, it requires fighting hard back and creating products in the absence of there being a tax on CO2, creating products that don't rely on the relative economics of using hydrocarbon fuels versus electric cars. And so that was our goal from Tesla from the beginning. And I'm excited to see that we've achieved that goal, actually, with the Model S, which, as was mentioned, Model S was recently awarded top honors by it was awarded sort of Car of the Year and Automobile of the Year, and that was against a very difficult field of gasoline cars, and so I'm hopeful that this will be seen as a pivotal moment in transport where people you know, finally appreciated that an electric car could be better than a gasoline car. And then going into the future, our goal with Tesla is to keep refining the technology, increasing the scale of production, and make a mass market electric car that almost anyone can afford. That's step three on the strategy. So step one was a high price, low volume. Step two, mid price, mid volume. Step three, low price, high volume. So we're sort of at step two, and now we want to progress to step three as soon as possible. And we did get quite a bit of criticism at Tesla for creating the Roadster, which we did in collaboration with Lotus. And people were complaining, well, why are you making this expensive sports car? And with the implication that we felt there was a shortage of sports cars for rich people, and we're racing to meet that unmet need, you know. So the real reason is that any car that we make at low volume, which is the first version of technology, is going to be expensive. It didn't matter what that car looked like. So we could make something that looked like a very standard, you know, sort of Toyota Corolla or, you know, Ford Fusion or something like that, and it would have cost, say, $70,000. But nobody will pay that for what looks like a mid-size economy sedan. They just won't. Or very few people would. But people are willing to pay $100,000 for a fast sports car. And so that's why we started off at that level. And then with another big design iteration and an increase in volume, so we had economies of scale, we were able to create the Model S. And then with another order of magnitude increase in volume and another big design revision, that's what will allow us to cut the price in half again. And then Tesla also supplies powertrains to Mercedes and Toyota and perhaps other, will do that for other car companies in an effort to help them accelerate the transition to electric vehicles. So that's Tesla and SpaceX. And I should mention certainly SolarCity, because one must generate electricity in a sustainable way as well as consume it in a sustainable way. And people will say, well, what don't electric cars create pollution at the power plant level? It should be noted that for any given source fuel, it is always better to generate the power at the power plant level and then charge electric cars and run them for any given source fuel, because power plants are much more efficient at extracting the energy than internal combustion engines in a car. They're at least twice as efficient, and usually more like three times as efficient. So for any given source fuel, it's always, you know, even if the whole world were always going to be powered by hydrocarbons, it would still make sense to do electric cars. But of course, we must find a sustainable means of generating energy as well. And I think that the most likely, well, the main candidate for energy generation is actually solar. I mean, I think the physics of this is actually rather obvious. Because the Earth is actually almost entirely solar powered today as it is. It would be a frozen ice ball at, I don't know, 3 or 4 Kelvin if it weren't for the sun. And our entire system of precipitation is powered by the sun. The ecosystem is almost entirely 99.999% powered by the sun, except for some chemotrophs at the bottom of the ocean. So that's it's rather obvious that, and I think once you try to take a little portion of that energy, and it's actually not much, and convert that into electricity for use by society. So I'm quite confident that solar power will be the single largest source of energy or electrical energy for humanity in the future, it will be combined with other things, of course, such as hydropower and geothermal, and I actually think nuclear is not a terrible option, as long as you're not located in a place that's susceptible to natural disasters. That's also, I think, defies common sense. But so as long as there aren't huge earthquakes or sort of weather systems that have names coming at you, then I think nuclear can be a sensible option. And there are much safer and better ways of generating nuclear energy, I'm talking fission here, than than existed in the past when nuclear reactors first came out. And then at some point in the future, it'd be nice to make fusion work. Of course, that would be quite good. But in the meantime, I think indirect fusion, being solar power, is a good thing to do. And so that's what Solar City is doing. It's really trying to improve the economics of solar power, and they're doing a great job. I don't run the company, so the credit for Solar City really goes to the two key guys who run that company. But they're doing a great job of really accelerating the adoption of solar power in the United States. And hopefully they'll come to the UK as well. So that's about it.
Wow. Way to go, Elon.
Wow. Yeah, I have to say, I'm impressed.
I would go so far as to say I'd invest in SpaceX and in Tesla.
I can do you one better, Nicholas.
No, you can't.
While this talk was happening, I actually bent the knee and got on my phone and used an online investment platform to buy 2 shares of Tesla, which is all I can actually afford.
Oh my goodness. No, you didn't.
You know what? It wasn't the talk alone, though. I have to say this. I recently went for a drive in a Tesla S, and it was amazing.
So let's get this straight. So you used a phone.
I used my iPhone.
Designed in California, made in China.
By Apple.
By Apple. Who used to be run by the other...
Esteban Jobs.
The other deity of the industrial world.
Correct. Although, I mean, like, you know, in a way, a strikingly more, I would dare to say, amoral industrialist. I think Steve Jobs didn't really care who died in China.
No.
Whereas, like, the Gigafactory in Nevada sounds like it's going to work out pretty well, even though Mr. Musk is stridently anti-union, which is interesting.
Yeah, but I think it's more of a... he's coming in at a different time. So I read recently that Apple has something like $100 million in cash on their books. Mm-hmm. Some obscene amount of cash for a company.
A really unique financial management strategy, so right. far as it goes. Yeah.
So the economic analysis I was reading said something to the effect that, so Apple's committed to moving some production to the United States.
For example, for the new Mac Pro.
Right. So whereas, you know, 10, 15 years ago, it was economically efficient to move production overseas because the labor is cheaper and there's less regulation. Now it's reaching a point of stabilization where the cultural and symbolic capital involved in moving your production back to the U.S. and exchanging the cash for that for factories in the United States levels out with having the thing shipped back and forth to China.
Right, right. Also, And correct me if I'm wrong here, Elon, but a lot of manufacturing companies are also moving to Mexico because it actually, although there's other problems with moving to Mexico, for example, land costs are higher, labor costs a little bit more than it does in China, but then your logistics cost drastically decreases.
Right.
So therefore you're shipping, you're like JIT shipping relationship is much reduced. Your investment in complex logistics and the expenses. So at this point, we're getting to a stage where for consumer goods, how they're shipped matters almost as much as how they are manufactured.
Right. I mean,
which is actually what's driving the thrust of industrialization in Mexico.
I mean, that is the new face of industry, is it this kind of lean business wherein a company doesn't want any back stock on the shelves. They want a system that is completely on demand.
Well, this is called JIT, and it's been this way since the 80s when the Japanese introduced it into auto manufacturing.
Right.
which is the main problem with the Detroit auto manufacturers in the 80s, which is why Toyota and Honda ate their lunch.
Right. But it's finally catching up into all sectors of industrial production.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. But where the cost of a JIT infrastructure in China is now outstripped the benefit of radically cheaper manufacturing, even though Mexico poses its own problems, i.e. corruption, i.e. more manufacturing problems than in China in some cases.
Less technical laborers.
For example, yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
You know, I think the thing that impressed me most about, or the moment that impressed me most about Elon's talk tonight was this thing of when he approached the task of rocket building.
Oh yeah,
he talked about this difference between what he said was the way a physicist would look at the problem by analyzing its basic principles,
mm-hmm.
and then the way maybe a businessman or entrepreneurial endeavor would look at the problem through analogy by looking at other companies and
right.
whatnot.
Right.
And so this really resonated with me. I feel like this is kind of how I've approached trying to make art.
Right, right. Like as a problem, not as through analogy.
Right, not as looking around at what else happens to be going on at the moment and trying to extrapolate, but rather what is the situation here and how do we extend what's possible?
You know, it's interesting also about Elon's talk was how he tried to move from analogy. Well, so what I mean to say, sorry, not how he tried to move from analogy, but how he gave analogy a shot anyway, like by trying to buy an ICBM.
Yeah, which failed, right?
Yeah, and this is amazing. Like, it's like, and it wasn't because people weren't willing to sell him the ICBM in the end.
Mm-hmm.
Like, it failed for its own like, the deal fell apart like any deal for anything could fall apart.
And maybe this is what I'm trying to get at. This, to me, Elon Musk is an amazing triumph of the scientific method, right?
Right.
I studied science. The first thing they tell you is that, you know, you start with a hypothesis, you test it, you experiment. If it doesn't work, you begin again with a new hypothesis and you go forward in this kind of way and you keep going until it works out.
Right.
And this seems to be the way in which his career has progressed.
I mean, a part of me remains suspicious, and I feel like that's inevitable. I think with our fundamentally Marxist anti-industrial background, that lingering whiff of suspicion does remain.
You think he is the singular white gay male in charge of everything?
Oh, he's not a gay male. Not that I know of.
Yeah, we don't know. I don't think if a gay white male is in charge of everything, I don't think we'd know.
Tim Cook.
Good call.
Everyone knows he's gay. No, I mean, really, like, it's a fact.
That's true, but maybe that's why he's not in charge of everything.
Does Tim Cook have an art collection?
I mean, he has an art advisor.
But does he actually, though?
I'm sure.
How about Elon Musk? I wonder. He's already, by the way, the squad of Teslas left the parking lot at Kaechung in Delta formation, so he's not here to answer right now.
There's one still here. He passed out on the couch.
He's on. Yeah, they left him. That's some Ayn Rand business right there. If I can just say that's not a solidarity move when you leave your homie passed out on the couch, his Tesla in the fucking Kaechung yard. I don't know what that says.
I think it says take an Uber.
Yeah, that does say take an. All right, you got me. All right, but finish your point.
I'm lost. What was my point?
Oh, we were talking about buying an ICBM. Golly. Anyway, can I just say I'm really excited about the new, more affordable Tesla cars?
Tell us about it, Steve.
They're making a new crossover, so it'll be like the Tesla RAV4.
So you could take it to Joshua Tree?
Yeah, it's got clearance.
Yep.
It's got everything. And then after that, they're going to make a production line like a economy car, almost.
Wait, so if you were driving your Tesla from, say, Chinatown to Joshua Tree, where would you charge in between, or would you need to?
How far is it from Chinatown to Joshua Tree?
It takes about 3 hours, going about 60 miles.
How many miles is that?
I would say average 60 miles an hour.
You're going to have to do that math in your head.
So 3 hours at 60 miles an hour would be a million miles.
No, shut up. No, it wouldn't be. Come on.
I don't do mental math at this hour.
You're the physics degree holder. 180
miles.
I believe that is fully within the charge range of any production line Tesla. They get at least 200 and something miles a charge.
Right, but the return trip would be 360 miles.
You'd have to charge in Joshua Tree.
Probably in Palm Springs.
Fair.
Yeah,
but
at the Whole Foods.
At the Whole Foods, but like you would actually just charge it in JT from solar if Mr. Musk has his way.
Yeah.
Because solar is something that you've definitely got in JT.
People seem to have that.
If you're driving a Tesla, you probably aren't just like staying at the motorhome place. Too. You're probably staying at your own place in JT, huh?
Maybe. Or the
where you have your own solar panels to charge your electric car.
What is the hotel where Graham Parsons died?
Oh, I've swum in the pool. The Palm Hotel
or
something.
Palm 49.
Something like that.
29 yeah. Palms Inn.
No.
No?
Because it's in Joshua Tree. It's not in 49 Palms. 29 Palms.
Hmm.
I want to say the Thunder River, but I know it's the hotel in Marfa.
They like counting palms out there.
It's the palms. Do you... We have ace engineer, studio... Wednesday Night Studio Manager Brett in the room right now. Do you know the name of the place where Brett Graham Parsons died?
No, I know the room has a fucking sign damn near on it that says Graham Parsons died here.
Yeah, the swimming pool also has a sign saying Graham Parsons died in this hotel.
And then died in this room.
Yeah. I wonder if Nelson's house has a big sign outside saying, advertising everyone who died in it.
It's like, supposedly the story is that a bunch of girls that were with him put ice cubes up his butt in the shower to try to revive him. I wonder if they like kept the bath from 1969, which is now nearing 50 years, to say, this is the bathtub where Graham Parsons was not really revived while ice cubes were shoved up his anus.
That makes my sphincter curl.
I feel like a new life has been just pumped into me. That gave me the second wind that I was looking for. Anyway, thank you, Elon, for coming by the studio.
I mean, he's already gone.
And the shareholders all left in their Teslas.
Elon, you can't even slide a nose hair in his schedule. He is so productive.
He is actually going back to work. Right now.
He does
SpaceX from midnight until 6 in the morning. He sleeps for 2 hours. Then he wakes up and does Tesla. Then he has an afternoon nap and then plays with his kids.
It's even better than that, listeners. What you couldn't see in the studio is that Elon was writing emails during his talk.
It's true. It's outrageous. Yeah. I have never seen a more productive man in my whole life.
Right.
If there was ever a model for us... For all of us, dare we say it? Thank you, Mr. Musk.
Yeah, productivity is the new religion.
Good night, Chinatown. Don't sleep in.
Don't sleep.
Work.
Why would you sleep?
Work so hard.
Why would you sleep?
Good night. Work really hard.
Why would you sleep?
Don't sleep. Otherwise, you'll never found. The most amazing electric car company.
You'll amount to nothing.
Try sleeping on that, loser.
Yeah, don't sleep.